Chapter 26. Sophie came at 7 to dress me. She was very long indeed in accomplishing her task, so long that Mr. Rochester, grown, I suppose, impatient of my delay, sent up to ask why I did not come. She was just fastening my veil, the plain square of blonde after all, to my hair with a brooch. I hurried from under her hands as soon as I could. "Stop!" she cried in French. "Look at yourself in the mirror. You have not taken one peep." So I turned at the door. I saw a robed and veiled figure, so unlike my usual self that it seemed almost the image of a stranger. "Jane!" called a voice, and I hastened down. I was received at the foot of the stairs by Mr. Rochester.
"Lingerer!" he said. "My brain is on fire with impatience, and you tarry so long!"
He took me into the dining-room, surveyed me keenly all over, pronounced me fair as a lily, and not only the pride of his life, but the desire of his eyes, and then telling me he would give me but 10 minutes to eat some breakfast, he rang the bell. One of his lately hired servants, a footman, answered it.
"Is John getting the carriage ready?"
"Yes, sir."
"Is the luggage brought down?"
"They are bringing it down, sir."
"Go you to the church, see if Mr. Wood, the clergyman, and the clerk are there. Return and tell me."
The church, as the reader knows, was but just beyond the gates. The footman soon returned.
"Mr. Wood is in the vestry, sir, putting on his surplice."
"And the carriage?"
"The horses are harnessing."
"We shall not want it to go to church, but it must be ready the moment we return. All the boxes and luggage arranged and strapped on, and the coachman in his seat."
"Yes, sir." "Jane, are you ready?"
I rose. There were no groomsmen, no bridesmaids, no relatives to wait for or marshal. None but Mr. Rochester and I. Mrs. Fairfax stood in the hall as we passed. I would fain have spoken to her, but my hand was held by a grasp of iron. I was hurried along by a stride I could hardly follow, and to look at Mr. Rochester's face was to feel that not a second of delay would be tolerated for any purpose. I wonder what other bridegroom ever looked as he did, so bent up to a purpose, so grimly resolute, or who, under such steadfast brows, ever revealed such flaming and flashing eyes. I know not whether the day was fair or foul in descending the drive. I gazed neither on sky nor earth. My heart was with my eyes, and both seemed migrated into Mr. Rochester's frame. I wanted to see the invisible thing on which, as we went along, he appeared to fasten a glance fierce and fell. I wanted to feel the thoughts whose force he seemed breasting and resisting. At the churchyard wicket he stopped. He discovered I was quite out of breath.
"Am I cruel in my love?" he said. "Delay an instant. Lean on me, Jane."
And now I can recall the picture of the grey old house of God rising calm before me, of a rook wheeling round the steeple, of a ruddy morning sky beyond. I remember something, too, of the green grave mounds, and I have not forgotten either, two figures of strangers straying amongst the low hillocks and reading the mementos graven on the few mossy headstones. I noticed them, because, as they saw us, they passed round to the back of the church, and I doubted not they were going to enter by the side aisle door and witness the ceremony. By Mr. Rochester they were not observed. He was earnestly looking at my face, from which the blood had, I dare say, momentarily fled, for I felt my forehead dewy and my cheeks and lips cold. When I rallied, which I soon did, he walked gently with me up the path to the porch. We entered the quiet and humble temple. The priest waited in his white surplice at the lowly altar, the clerk beside him. All was still. Two shadows only moved in a remote corner. My conjecture had been correct. The strangers had slipped in before us.
and they now stood by the vault of the Rochesters, their backs towards us, viewing through the rails the old-time stained marble tomb, where a kneeling angel guarded the remains of Damer de Rochester, slain at Marston Moor in the time of the civil wars, and of Elizabeth, his wife. Our place was taken at the communion rails. Hearing a cautious step behind me, I glanced over my shoulder. One of the strangers, a gentleman evidently, was advancing up the chancel. The service began. The explanation of the intent of matrimony was gone through, and then the clergyman came a step further forward, and bending slightly towards Mr. Rochester, went on, "I require and charge you both, as ye will answer at the dreadful day of judgment, when the secrets of all hearts shall be disclosed, that if either of you know any impediment why ye may not lawfully be joined together in matrimony, ye do now confess it, for be ye well assured that so many as are coupled together otherwise than God's word doth allow are not joined together by God, neither is their matrimony lawful." He paused, as the custom is. When is the pause after that sentence ever broken by reply? Not perhaps once in 100 years. And the clergyman, who had not lifted his eyes from his book, and had held his breath but for a moment, was proceeding. His hand was already stretched towards Mr. Rochester, as his lips unclosed to ask, "Wilt thou have this woman for thy wedded wife?" when a distinct and near voice said, "The marriage cannot go on. I declare the existence of an impediment." The clergyman looked up at the speaker and stood mute. The clerk did the same. Mr. Rochester moved slightly, as if an earthquake had rolled under his feet. Taking a firmer footing and not turning his head or eyes, he said, "Proceed." Profound silence fell when he had uttered that word, with deep but low intonation. Presently Mr. Wood said, "I cannot proceed without some investigation into what has been asserted and evidence of its truth or falsehood." "The ceremony is quite broken off," subjoined the voice behind us. "I am in a condition to prove my allegation. An insuperable impediment to this marriage exists." Mr. Rochester heard, but heeded not. He stood stubborn and rigid, making no movement but to possess himself of my hand. What a hot and strong grasp he had, and how like quarried marble was his pale, firm, massive front at this moment. How his eye shone, still watchful, and yet wild beneath. Mr. Wood seemed at a loss. "What is the nature of the impediment?" he asked. "Perhaps it may be got over, explained away." "Hardly," was the answer. "I have called it insuperable, and I speak advisedly." The speaker came forward and leaned on the rails. He continued uttering each word distinctly, calmly, steadily, but not loudly. "It simply consists in the existence of a previous marriage. Mr. Rochester has a wife now living." My nerves vibrated to those low-spoken words, as they had never vibrated to thunder. My blood felt their subtle violence, as it had never felt frost or fire. But I was collected, and in no danger of swooning. I looked at Mr. Rochester. I made him look at me. His whole face was colourless rock. His eye was both spark and flint. He disavowed nothing. He seemed as if he would defy all things. Without speaking, without smiling, without seeming to recognize in me a human being, he only twined my waist with his arm and riveted me to his side. "Who are you?" he asked of the intruder. "My name is Briggs, a solicitor of Street, London. And you would thrust on me a wife? I would remind you of your lady's existence, sir, which the law recognizes if you do not. Favor me with an account of her, with her name, her parentage, her place of abode." "Certainly," Mr. Briggs calmly took a paper from his pocket and read out in a sort of official nasal voice, "I affirm and can prove that on the 20th of October A.D., a date of 15 years back, Edward Fairfax Rochester of Thornfield Hall in the county of, and of Ferndean Manor in Sheringland, was married to my sister, Bertha Antoinetta Mason, daughter of Jonas Mason, merchant, and of Antoinetta, his wife, a Creole, at Church, Spanish Town, Jamaica. The record of the marriage will be found in the register of that church. A copy of it is now in my possession. Signed, Richard Mason. That, if a genuine document, may prove I have been married, but it does not prove that the woman mentioned therein as my wife is still living." "She was living 3 months ago," returned the lawyer. "How do you know? I have a witness to the fact whose testimony even you, sir, will scarcely controvert. Produce him or go to hell." "I will produce him first. He is on the spot. Mr. Mason, have the goodness to step forward."
Mr. Rochester, on hearing the name, set his teeth. He experienced, too, a sort of strong convulsive quiver. Near to him as I was, I felt the spasmodic movement of fury or despair run through his frame. The second stranger, who had hitherto lingered in the background, now drew near. A pale face looked over the solicitor's shoulder. Yes, it was Mason himself. Mr. Rochester turned and glared at him. His eye, as I have often said, was a black eye. It had now a tawny, nay, a bloody light in its gloom, and his face flushed. Olive cheek and hueless forehead received a glow as from spreading, ascending heart fire. And he stirred, lifted his strong arm. He could have struck Mason, dashed him on the church floor, shocked by ruthless blow the breath from his body. But Mason shrank away and cried faintly, "Good God!" Contempt fell cool on Mr. Rochester. His passion died as if a blight had shriveled it up. He only asked, "What have you to say?" An inaudible reply escaped Mason's white lips. "The devil is in it if you cannot answer distinctly. I again demand, what have you to say?"
"Sir, sir," interrupted the clergyman, "do not forget you are in a sacred place."
Then addressing Mason, he inquired gently,
"Are you aware, sir, whether or not this gentleman's wife is still living?"
"Courage," urged the lawyer. "Speak out."
"She is now living at Thornfield Hall," said Mason in more articulate tones. "I saw her there last April. I am her brother."
"At Thornfield Hall?" ejaculated the clergyman. "Impossible. I am an old resident in this neighbourhood, sir, and I never heard of a Mrs. Rochester at Thornfield Hall."
I saw a grim smile contort Mr. Rochester's lips, and he muttered,
"No, by God, I took care that none should hear of it, or of her under that name."
He mused. For 10 minutes he held counsel with himself. He formed his resolve and announced it,
"Enough! All shall bolt out at once, like the bullet from the barrel. Wood, close your book and take off your surplice. John Green," to the clerk, "leave the church. There will be no wedding today."
The man obeyed. Mr. Rochester continued, hardily and recklessly,
"Bigamy is an ugly word. I meant, however, to be a bigamist, but fate has outmaneuvered me. Or Providence has checked me, perhaps the last. I am little better than a devil at this moment, and, as my pastor there would tell me, deserve no doubt the sternest judgments of God, even to the quenchless fire and deathless worm. Gentlemen, my plan is broken up. What this lawyer and his client say is true. I have been married, and the woman to whom I was married lives.
You say you never heard of a Mrs. Rochester at the house up yonder wood, but I dare say you have many a time inclined your ear to gossip about the mysterious lunatic, kept there under watch and ward. Some have whispered to you that she is my bastard half-sister, some my cast-off mistress. I now inform you that she is my wife, whom I married 15 years ago, Bertha Mason by name, sister of this resolute personage, who is now, with his quivering limbs and white cheeks, showing you what a stout heart men may bear. Cheer up, Dick. Never fear me. I'd almost as soon strike a woman as you. Bertha Mason is mad, and she came of a mad family, idiots and maniacs through 3 generations. Her mother, the Creole, was both a madwoman and a drunkard, as I found out after I had wed the daughter, for they were silent on family secrets before. Bertha, like a dutiful child, copied her parent in both points. I had a charming partner, pure, wise, modest. You can fancy I was a happy man. I went through rich scenes. Oh, my experience has been heavenly, if you only knew it. But I owe you no further explanation. Briggs, Wood, Mason, I invite you all to come up to the house and visit Mrs. Poole's patient and my wife. You shall see what sort of a being I was cheated into espousing, and judge whether or not I had a right to break the compact and seek sympathy with something at least human. This girl, he continued, looking at me, knew no more than you would of the disgusting secret. She thought all was fair and legal, and never dreamt she was going to be entrapped into a feigned union with a defrauded wretch, already bound to a bad, mad, and imbruted partner. Come, all of you, follow!"